Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and currently writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today is...
Laura Richards. I'm director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and also criminal behavioral analyst, activist, and advocate, and also co-creator and co-producer on CBS's The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, where Jim Clementi is my colleague. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And today we're really excited to be sitting down with Heather McDonald, who is also one of the Wondery podcasters. And she's also the star of Juicy Scoop. And we're going to be discussing today, and it will be somewhat wild and certainly unscripted, but we're really looking forward to talking about the gift of listening with Heather.
Well, I first want to apologize to you because I did not recognize from the JonBenet documentary. I only recognized the beautiful blonde.
Yeah, I'm certainly not the beautiful blonde, so don't
worry
about it.
Thank you, Heather.
No,
that's very kind.
Necessary. I was making a joke. I was making light of it because...
He wanted to be recognized.
Yeah.
And
you
didn't
like,
recognize
you literally
him, so
you're like yelling at me. Like, how could I not? How could you not recognize
you're
not
wearing
him?
Your
so
hat.
Distinct
that's
looking.
Why. You're not wearing your hat.
I didn't wear my hat on the show.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Well, it was an amazing... it was an amazing... I guess you'd say documentary. It was a documentary.
It was a reinvestigation.
A reinvestigation, yeah. Okay. But it was really everyone could not stop talking about it. So to have you guys here is great. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I was listening to ones about, it was interesting because I was looking to listen to some. I was like, what's the murder of Meredith? And it was really known as the Amanda Knoxville case, except Meredith was the actual victim. And so it was really cool that you guys... focused on her and mm-hmm. gave her a name that I don't think a lot of people remember. Because again, I love true crime, so I feel like I know a lot of 48-hour mysteries, and I watch them when they're regurgitated on other shows. And it's really rare that there's a murder that involves like sex and love and marriage that I am not in pretty much knowledgeable of.
Well, I think the challenge with that particular case was the narrative got changed, and you know, people started calling it the Amanda Knox case, which
right.
it never was. And of course, you know, I'm from the UK, so you know, it was very important that it was about Meredith right from the start.
Because
in
she's
the UK.
From the UK.
Yes, and you know, certainly when Jim and I started talking about it, you know, and our podcast as well, Real Crime Profile, we really wanted to give a voice to the voiceless, and you know, the victim's voice has been a key part. So, you know, I was giving a talk at Pepperdine University, and I asked how many people in the audience had heard of the case of Meredith Kircher, and four people put their hands up. And then I asked the same question, how many people have heard of Amanda Knox? Everyone had their hands up.
Wow.
So this is how victims get written out,
you know,
become footnotes in their own murders, which is why we did the case of Nicole Brown as well as Ron Goldman, so that we could correct the narrative and put the victims quite rightly at the center of it.
Right. And the same thing with Making a Murderer, we talked about Teresa Holbach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
the woman who was murdered.
Yes. Yeah, because
not Stephen Avery.
Right, because when we actually do criminal behavioral analysis, the first thing we look at is victimology. We study the victim because an offender picks a particular victim at a particular time, in a particular place, in a particular manner for a particular purpose. And all those choices reflect back on the offender and what their skills and abilities and desires and hopes and plans are with this victim. And because of that, it's when you look at the victim, it reflects back on the offender. It's like holding up a mirror to the offender. And so that's the first thing we study. And it's also the person who had a crime committed against them, who lost their voice because they were killed or assaulted or whatever happened to them. And so our job, as we see it, Laura and I and Lisa helps us do it, is to bring life back to the victims.
And that's one of the reasons why we created the podcast in the first place.
Yes,
because,
let's talk about that.
Because Jim and Laura wanted to, and I wanted to help them create a platform where they could do what they just did just now, is go deep into the subject matter. Now, if they were on another show, like a CNN or whatever, they would be confined, like 30 seconds to talk about it. And also in, you know, what that host wants to talk about.
Right.
It would be the Amanda Knox thing. You would never even hear about Meredith. But on our show, we can talk about whatever the heck we want to, for as long as we want to. And we're not beholden to the studio or the network or the da-da-da-da-da telling us what to do. And I just really cherish that. It's very empowering for me. It makes me feel very creative that we can go down any path we want to. And there's no programming. There's no, you know, Jim and I live and die by the ratings of our day jobs. And we're constantly worried about that. And while, you know, we want to have lots of listeners and we want to have great sponsors, that's not why we do this. We would do this no matter what the number was.
Right. And Lisa's kind of the role of the voice of the people. So when Jim and I start getting, you know, we deep dive into some of the jargon and the kind of the technical point side that converse in, Lisa will just bring us back and say, hang on, what does that mean? What does the word victimology mean?
Right. You know,
and then we can explain it. And the other key reason for Jim C and I is that it's about educating and raising awareness as well about issues that people don't really talk about. So things like coercive control, which we did through the case of Nicole and Ron Goldman, you know, and of course people would always refer to that as the O.J. Simpson case, but we started to peel back all the real detail and the layers about Nicole's life and how she was actually being coercively controlled and stalked, mm-hmm. and then the culmination of that was the domestic homicide. So the mm-hmm. education part is really important to us.
Yeah, and another thing that I think might have been a surprise to Lisa, but I think Laura and I expected it, was the fact that we're talking about services and people were reaching out to us for help, and particularly Laura and Paladin Service, which is a victims advocacy group that Laura started in the UK, and she's trying to bring it over here to the US.
It's for victims of stalking and also domestic violence. And the UK service has helped in excess of 2,000 people. And whenever we podcast here, we get lots of cases, many of whom, you know, victims will write to me or their mothers or their loved ones. So a good example of being able to sort of educate and raise awareness is the podcast that we decided to do on sort of the arc of the People versus O.J. Simpson. But our focus was very much on Nicole Brown Simpson as well as Ron Goldman. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking at the coercive control that she suffered at his hands and actually did for many years of the relationship, and really showing the abuse for what it was, what the high risk factors were, how he micromanaged her, how she feared for her life on numerous occasions and called the police. And, you know, in the UK, myself along with others had changed the law on coercive control, and the new law came in December 2015, but I think it's a kind of a new term for people who don't really understand domestic violence. So it's really a good way through our podcast that we can educate people.
Can I ask a question about the Nicole Brown situation?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, so one thing I found interesting, now I told you that I'd read the Faye Resnick book 20-something years ago, and then I read it again recently, and everything she said in there really rang true with the knowledge we have now. But one thing I found really interesting was when Nicole went back to him, when she said, someone said, oh, I saw OJ and he's really in love with Paula Barbieri or whatever her name was. And he says he's a changed man and he's really going to make it work. He's not going to cheat on Paula because he was always cheating on Nicole. And then she immediately called him and was like, let's give our family another chance. And Faye said, what are you doing? What are you thinking? Like, why would you want this person back? And she wanted to try it. And so then he said, okay. And he kept saying, if she dumps me, if she screws me over again. And sure enough, they went on a trip and he started to piss her off. And she was like, you know what? I don't want this. I don't want him anymore. And what does that mean when a woman knows she's in a dangerous situation, yet is kind, and I can say bad words on my show, it's like fucking with, like, do they not see how serious it is at the time that they feel they can go back and forth with someone that's treated them so poorly?
Well, it's about understanding sort of the psychological end of abuse. And, you know, certainly with victims, it normally takes them at least 7 attempts to leave a perpetrator. Mm. So, you know, you can imagine when you're, you know, we're talking about relationships where people are emotionally invested as well, where children are
right.
present. And Nicole, by all accounts, was a very good mum. Mm-hmm. And she wanted them to have their father
right.
present in their life. She wanted the best for them. But coercive control is a very, you know, insidious thing, because it really does get under the skin. And the tentacles, you know, are very deeply rooted in the psychological aspect. So Nicole did try and leave numerous times. Every time he would try and win her back. Yes, and there may well have been times when Nicole wanted to get back with him.
Yeah, because they were already legally, everything was final. She was moved out, they were divorced.
The key thing with victims is the one thing I know from working with victims for 20 years is that they all want the same thing. They want the relationship, but they don't want the abuse. And so this is where the conflict comes in, because mm-hmm. when you're emotionally invested, when you love someone, you've invested everything, your lives are entwined and you right. have children.
And for her identity, because she met him at 17.
Correct. Yeah. And, all of those things that he would use, there was a complete power imbalance between the two of them. And for some time, she was probably happy with that. But then when she starts to assert herself and become her own woman and know her own mind, things start to escalate between them. And, certainly from everything I've read about Nicole, she did love him and she did want the relationship. She just wanted him to stop being abusive. And I think the question we should all be asking is why are men, in this situation we're talking about men, but why are perpetrators abusive? Why are we looking at the victims and judging them on what they did or didn't do?
Right.
And that's where we really want the lens to be focused back on the perpetrator. And I say, it's a man in this situation. We know that men and women can be abused. And certainly the psychological aspect, the coercive control, all victims have said to me that that's the most damaging. So, it's very easy to put people's lives under the microscope and judge them and say, well, she should have done and he should have done this. But actually, it becomes very complicated and complex when you've got children involved and when you've got affairs of the heart involved.
Right.
She loved him. Why couldn't he stop abusing her is the question that we should be asking. Mm-hmm. He's the one that got away with murder after all. She lost her life and yet still people are judging her.
And
yeah,
I think
I guess I did judge her, but I was trying to say
why
you were so lucky to get out and you were actually completely divorced. Like,
but she was never completely separated, was she? Yeah. Because the children, you see, and when you have children, it's the thing that's going to keep pulling you back into a situation. So, and I didn't mean you sort of judging,
yeah,
I mean collectively the world,
right.
Everyone asking questions of her behavior, and yet
I think it is what you said. I think when she heard that he said, I'm a changed man, I'm not going to cheat on this new girl, she thought, well, if we got back together, then if he's so changed, then he won't
he
cheat.
He can do that for me.
He won't cheat on me and he won't treat me badly. So, no, I do want it.
She wanted the non-abusive O.J. Simpson, didn't she? That's what she was saying. If he can be like that with her,
yeah.
I want the same. And if he can make those promises and keep them. But, of course, what she would have experienced was that he could not.
Right.
Be non-abusive. And so the minute he starts, whether it's psychologically, whether it's physically, because he used all the tactics that perpetrators do, and given his standing, given his charisma, given the fact people didn't believe her,
right.
All of those things kept her very much, glued to him. So
right.
I think she did want the relationship, and that's the very sad thing in a lot of cases that I've seen, particularly murders that I've reviewed. Where, the victims do want the relationship to be non-abusive and it's ended up, with them being murdered because the perpetrator takes very little or zero responsibility for their own behavior to change.
And I always think it's so interesting because of his charm. And he's the nicest guy in the world. Oh, I met him at a restaurant. He's the greatest guy. And it's like, well, yeah, people can be great to all these people. He did, he didn't kill everybody he came in contact with. He killed these two people. He didn't. So, of course, the fact that you had a nice friendship or a nice exchange with him when you waited on him at the Beverly Hills Hotel, doesn't mean that he couldn't murder.
That's
I think
right.
that's what was
and
so
I think
amazing to people. It's like, no, I
he
mean, of
used
course, you're going to be nice
as
when
one
you're
of his tactics.
Around.
You know, yeah. And charm and niceness, they're not characteristics, they're a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Someone takes a choice to use those tools. And I always say charm disarms.
Mm-hmm.
So, we all have to think about when people, pay us a lot of compliments, my view on that is, well, what do you want? Question mark.
Mm-hmm.
Are you trying to endear yourself to me and ingratiate yourself on me, or
the compliments.
Is there another motive for someone like OJ? Well, when sadly you work in the business that Jim and I do, you see things in a different way. But it's not to say that you make a judgment on everybody. It's just that you have a question in your mind, and some people use charm as a tactic and a tool. Psychopaths do to compliment people, to make them feel great. They put somebody on a pedestal, and then they slowly start to strip them down.
The victims typically have an idyllic fantasy of what the relationship is like in their mind, how great they were treated, how wonderful they felt in the beginning, and how that released endorphins in them that they're just so they want it again. It's like, you know, this they're fiending for a drug that they had before, this perfect image of this relationship. And then their self-image gets tied to that person, and that person, you know, putting them back on that pedestal. And so they're yearning for that as well. And it sounds to me like Nicole at that point thought, well, maybe he has changed. Maybe I do have an opportunity to have what I had before that I had been putting up with all this abuse for all this time with him for. And so she was going back to trying to get that what she had in the beginning of this relationship. She didn't recognize it as certainly threatening to her life at that point. Otherwise, she wouldn't have done that. All right, well, that seems like a good place to break, and we'll be back momentarily.
I know we need to move on, but I wanted to ask you, Laura. I mean, couldn't also OJ saying so publicly, yeah, I'm never going to cheat on Paula, isn't that like also a manipulation? Like he knows how that's going to land with Nicole, and that is a button that will push her towards him. I mean,
There's a high likelihood he said it for purpose.
Yeah, a very good couple friend of theirs that then immediately was like, we saw OJ.
Repeating it back to Nicole. Yeah. So it was probably, you know, and we can only say because he's the only one that knows, but given all his behavior, I would say, you know, he was a strategist and he would have in mind the things that he wanted, and he definitely wanted Nicole back. So the tools that he used, you know, and unfortunately he had affluence and standing, and people tended to gravitate towards him.
Right.
You know, and she was fully aware of that.
So getting back to what we love about listening to podcasts, do you guys listen to other podcasts? And if so, which ones?
Well, there's one that I tend to listen to very regularly, and more so when I'm out canyon running, are TED Talks. And
oh, yeah.
But I've
gotten
into, I don't know if you've heard the Radio Hour one, where they have, you know, a subject and then they have four different speakers talk to it in a very different way.
Oh,
and, you know,
cool.
It's fascinating, so much insight. And actually, one of their podcasts was on the art of listening, which I highly recommend, because there's some very interesting speakers who give a very different take about whether listening is for the journey of sort of discovery or whether it's empathy, and it kind of talks about it in very different ways.
Nice.
I like to listen to people and their stories. And one of my favorites is Truth and Justice podcast by Bob Ruff. I just think he has an amazing way of talking to people and getting to the bottom of stories. And he's doing a lot of investigations that really interest me as well. And I also like podcasts about how things work. I studied physics and chemistry in college, and then decided to go to law school because I loved criminal law. And so those are those two things kind of are my main sources of interest. I love learning about things and people and their stories.
I listen to a wide variety of podcasts that I stumble and crash into very randomly. You know, everything from, you know, Radiolab to America's Test Kitchen to a great podcast called Happier. And I actually used to listen to this podcast about snack food, which is insane because I don't even eat snack food. My children didn't have donuts until they were 10. But good podcasts have subject, style, and substance. They kind of all come together in that trifecta. So even if it's a subject that you have no interest in, if the style and the rapport of the podcaster grabs you, you'll go with it. And conversely, even if it's a subject that I love and I'm really into, but, you know, the podcasters are either really stuffy or I don't get their humor or their substance, they don't have a really deep grasp of what they're talking about, it kind of falls apart.
Yeah.
But my taste is just all over the place. And when Game of Thrones comes on again, I'm going to be looking for, you know, a good podcast to tune into. And there are a lot of them out there. So
I think it depends on your mood as well, doesn't it? And the window of time that you have and what you want to fill that window of time with.
Right.
And a lot comes down to the hosts, absolutely, the people that are on them.
I mean, you sort of answered this, but is there a particular story that really touched you from a listener?
We have a couple.
Okay.
I wanted to read when we've been talking about the domestic abuse angle, and we get a lot of letters and stories from people who are in horribly abusive situations. But this one just knocked the breath out of me. I don't know if it did for you, Laura. But
Well, it did. That's why I wanted to share it with you, and I forwarded it on because, you know, we do get so many. That's the thing. I haven't even added up how many we get a week. But
right.
this one,
she actually sent this to our Facebook page too. I mean, she was really trying to get this to us. So I'm going to read this. I'm not going to say her name. I wanted to send you, Jim, Laura, and Lisa, a message about your podcast. A little background. My daughter was killed at the school shooting in Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. I've been listening to your podcast for a while now, I guess since it started, and I've been very impressed with your focus on honoring victims and victims' voices. When you lose a loved one by the violent hands of another individual, there's this feeling of having no control, a loss of power. Someone else made a choice to affect your life and those around you forever, and you have to suck it up and live with it. Being in that place can feel very lonely and isolating, and it's hard to feel understood sometimes. So it's refreshing to listen to your podcast that helps not only giving a voice to victims, but also to empower those that are being abused, get help that they need without stigma. Thank you for all your work. A mom from San Diego.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
Yeah.
That was pretty amazing.
Sad. I can't even imagine.
There was another one that really resonates in my head as well, which, you know, really did have an impact, which was somebody who wrote, and again, I won't name her, but she said that she'd been listening to all of our episodes and that she was suffering from serious levels of abuse. And, you know, all the information that we'd been giving her and signposting her to Paladin and other services meant that she could then start to form a plan. And she actually had written the point where she had safely left her abusive partner. So, you know,
it was
uplifting as well. Yeah. And, you know, it's the reason why we put out, you know, the details for Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service in the UK and why we need a service here, but put out the domestic violence helpline. So it really shows that what we do is so important, but there is life after abuse. And that part was very uplifting about her life now.
That she's successful.
And one other thing is that a number of the people that write to us tell us that they didn't even recognize that they were in an abusive situation that could be dangerous until they listened to our podcast, until they heard examples of other people in that same kind of situation who ended up violently attacked or killed. And so I think it really opened up people's eyes as to what was going on in their own lives.
And we've told the stories in different ways, I guess, and that's, you know, through cases, talking about lots of different cases. You know, one of the things Jim C and I can do is kind of deconstruct them, the cases, and, you know, they're not just stories, they're people's lives, and we can talk about high risk factors, we can talk about the detail, and I think that's what people connect with, not with the labels domestic violence or stalking or, you know, any coercive control labels that are placed. So I think that has had a very profound impact on many people who wouldn't have probably got help, actually.
So what do you think makes podcasts stand out from other means of entertainment, like live stream and social media, Instagram, and all of that?
I would say that it's imagination. It's a callback or a throwback to the old radio serials. I think in those days, people would sit around listening to the radio and their brains would put together the pictures. And I think that's addictive. I think that really draws people in, and it engages people so much more. I think TV and movies took away from that. And even today, with all of the levels of animation and all the things that they can do that trick your mind into believing that it's actually there, I think it steps back. It's more like reading a great book that you don't want to put down.
Yeah.
Listening to a podcast. I'll sit there when I get to my destination and keep listening.
Right.
Because I don't want to stop hearing what the podcast is saying if they're in the middle of a good story or talking about some topic that I'm interested in. So I think it really engages my imagination. And I think, to me, that's my drug.
That's great. And what does it mean to be a good listener, Laura?
I mean, this is a very good question, and it's something that actually I have numerous slides on when I'm training professionals, police officers and others, when talking about using the DASH risk assessment model, which is a tool specifically for domestic violence and stalking and honour-based violence. And I really think, you know, the ratio, you've got two ears and one mouth, and the ratio that they should be used in should be exactly in that proportion. I certainly feel, you know, when we think about listening, there's active listening, there's reflective listening, and there's a lot of people who listen to talk, not listen to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those two things are very different. And I think, you know, listening to somebody is a mark of respect. And it's also a mark of validation, you know, and it's very empowering for someone to feel heard. And I think, you know, with a lot of the work that I've certainly done in the space with crime victims, it's about hearing them and giving people a voice and, you know, being patient, letting people explain their situation, not interrupting. You know, and I talk a lot to people and professionals in particular about when they interrupt people, particularly victims or anyone in their social circle, they will change what happens next, the whole dynamic when someone's in flow. So not only is it disrespectful, it also changes the person's narrative of probably what they're going to say next. They might think that the person's not interested in what they're saying next. They might think that they need to change because they can't deal with what they're saying next. There's lots of things, you know, particularly with a victim in crisis that will happen if the flow is interrupted. So I think what really makes a good listener is letting someone tell their story or have their say, have their view, not interrupting them. I think, you know, one of the good tools that you can do back to show someone that you've heard them is to sort of almost mimic back the last part of what they've said, to make someone feel that they've been heard and empowered and validated. But communication skills, I feel, you know, not everybody has fantastic communication skills. And I feel it's really something that should be talked to in schools and certainly with professionals. And having worked a lot in law enforcement, I think it's one of the grossly underrated and undervalued things of, you know, not just the art of listening, but the act of listening. And it should be very active. You know, and conscious as a process of giving somebody the space when they are talking and letting them feel and be heard.
Laura just said, reminded me, Heather, you and I are moms, and mimicking back to a child is very, very important. You know, they could, I was just on an airplane ride and there was a little boy going, "I want my grandma, I want my grandma." And the mom was trying to comfort the kid, but she never said, "You want grandma. I hear you. You want," you know, she was trying with toys and comforting him. And I just wanted to scream, "Just say it back to him. He just wants to hear you say that," you know.
Right.
And it's really important. And if this question means what does it mean to be a good listener, I'm not sure if that means like as far as a good listener to a podcast.
Uh-huh.
Because we have incredible listeners, I'm sure that you do too, who are writing to us all the time and, you know, correct us when we're inaccurate and show us lots of love and support, and they feel like they know us, and when you have a Facebook relationship or a Twitter relationship, you feel like you know them too. So I'm really grateful for our good.
Well, I think that Laura's right about active listening. I mean, it's one of the skills that the FBI teaches its interviewers so that they actually participate in listening. And although hearing is a physical process, listening is hearing and then actually reflecting on what you're hearing. And then it's a cognitive process. And so it's the first step in understanding and learning. And so it's an important part of building a bond with someone else. And whenever we want to interview someone, we build rapport with that person to show that we are similar, that there are things that we share as humans, in order to open sort of the floodgates of communication. And I think without actively listening, what you do a lot of times, what a lot of people end up doing, is only hearing what they want to hear and judging against what they hear that they don't want to hear. And that is not how communication happens. You actually have to be open to what the other person is saying, to understand it, to understand their perspective, and to see if there's any common ground between you. And I think that's a really important thing that people need to do in general, not just when they're in a law enforcement interview.
Okay, guys, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something else.
So how did you get into podcasting in the first place?
Well, I am a stand-up comedian, and I've written two books, My Inappropriate Life and You'll Never Blue Ball in This Town Again. Again, I loved all the books from the 90s, so there was a lot of books called You'll Never Make Love in This Town Again, You'll Never Have Lunch in This Town Again. My Love in This Town Again was about like high-class hookers, which is another thing I love. So I was an old virgin. So I was like, I have a lot of juicy stories. They just don't end in penetration. But let me, since it took place in the 90s. So I wrote that book. That was really fun. And then I wrote and produced Chelsea Lately for many years.
I was going to say, you have that vibe too. I was going to say, so you guys must be best friends or worst enemies. It's one of the two. It's
whatever. And so, it was a great time. And so I love pop culture but I also love juicy scoops, juicy stuff. So at a certain point after Chelsea Lately ended, I had a couple shows that didn't last. And I literally said, well, I guess it's time to do a podcast.
Cool.
But in a negative way is what I was really being honest like. Because so many comedians had them mm-hmm. and I'd been on so many, but I never was hearing or getting feedback. So I just did it thinking, this will give me something to do on Mondays because I like that structure because I was doing stand-up on the road. But I'm like, oh, I get to prepare a show like I used to on Chelsea Lately. So it was actually a huge surprise when people found it and really loved it. And then it was the greatest response I've ever gotten, better than the books, better than stand-up. Mm-hmm. So I've just grown to really love it and appreciate it. And it's been the surprise of my life, really. I didn't really think it would be this way. And now if I don't love the episode or I feel like I've never missed one and I just went to mm-hmm. 2 days a week. And
wow.
And it's very stressful because I'm I can't just skip an episode or how am I going to fit this in when I'm traveling? And then, if it's 3 hours late, you wake up to the angry tweets. And
disappointed tweets.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, where was it? I had my commute and I'm like, okay, just
very
wait
demanding.
A minute. Yeah.
They want
but,
it.
But it's so
the
flattering.
Commuters, that's
so,
very true.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
normal
yeah.
The commuters.
Absolutely.
Very flattering though. And it makes me really happy. And then it's really driven my people coming to see me live when I do stand up. So mm-hmm. I love it. So it's been good.
My husband is a former stand up too. Uh-huh. And like you said, he doesn't do it now, but his outlet is doing his podcast. He does a daily podcast. He's done 1,500 episodes in a row. So
yeah.
Did you hear that? A daily podcast
yeah.
for 3 years? Over
yes,
3 years.
Yes, over 3 years. But I remember when he was traveling and we were first dating and took me on the road. And this is how much in love we were is he took me to this hotel where they put him up and I opened the window and the view was of tires, rubber tires stacked up outside.
Sounds very romantic, Lisa. Very romantic.
And yet it was so romantic. But good for you. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You guys probably know a lot of people.
Did he pick that room in particular?
No, it's the club picks your lodgings.
Right.
You don't
okay.
have a say in it.
Yeah.
So, of course, we're like, oh, this is so romantic.
Now I do.
Right.
Now I say cute cities only is my policy.
So what's your favorite episode of your show and why?
I think probably one of my favorite episodes was just one that I had with a fellow comedian, Chris Frangiola, and he was on Chelsea Lately with me, and we just went through stories that were in the news, but also I had a really funny 4th of July week with my family and my kids, and I'd ran into an old boyfriend, and just telling the story to a really good friend, because sometimes I do stuff just by myself, it made for just... He makes me funnier. I like the camaraderie of having other people mm-hmm. on sometimes. So for me, that was the most fun. But I mean, I've had great episodes that I do. I told a very intimate story that I never shared in my books or my stand-up about a relationship I have with my sister or their lack of. And it is something that is probably not even explored much in anything, but it's sort of like abusive adult sibling relationships that are not necessarily physical, but they just keep coming back and the parents push you to have them in your wedding and push, she should be able to come see you after you give birth and, things like that, that just continued on. And it took getting married to my husband, who did not come from that weird Catholic dysfunctional family, to say, she can't just walk into our house. And so I started to tell the whole story, which spans over 15 years. And I said, well, this story is going to take about 3 hours to tell. So I'm going to tell it in the beginning of each episode of Juicy Scoop. And I called it Serial Sister, being the most popular podcast. I was like, let's see, and it was amazing the response I got of people being like, no one ever talks about this. I thought I was the only one that felt like this. I feel such guilt. I just want to raise my own children. I don't want this trauma drama that I grew up with around me. And it was it was like the greatest therapy because
it's very cathartic. It was. I mean,
I would come in with Ray, my podcaster, and I'd be like, another episode of therapy, you know. But then when it was done, when I got to the end, it was like, oh my God, I could have gone to therapy and talked to some woman
and paid a lot of money
and had one person's response and opinion, but instead I got hundreds,
right.
You know, hundreds and thousands of people that listened and loved it and got into it and got to see my side because I had, you know, very close members in my family that thought I was awful for telling the story. And so part of me telling the story was like, I love the podcast because by able to having the freedom of the podcast of telling the truth, once you put it out there,
yeah.
It's like nobody, it's so freeing. It's like no one can touch you. They can't say you're lying. Oh, fine, you think I'm lying. Why don't you listen to episode 35 to 51? Yeah. Why don't you listen? And so then recently I had a situation with my former podcast owner who was gross and a sexual harasser. And I had the audio and I kept it to myself for 6 months. And then after all the stuff with Donald Trump and Roger Ailes, I was like, why am I protecting this person that was awful? And then when I left, he was awful. Like, he tried to not let me leave. And I was like, and I know people in the office are suffering. And I'm like, well, but then I asked myself, well, can someone talk to me disgusting like this since I'm this female comedian that, you know, is somewhat R-rated? And so I kind of put it out like that. And that was an amazing response. In that I just go, look, I know it's not rape. I know it's not assault. It's not someone grabbing you. But what has happened when you've been sexually harassed in the workplace? And it's been so many different stories. And sometimes it's just like a girl at her cubicle and it's some gross guy who's talking about, comes right up to her and is like, oh, so I was, going down on my wife last night. And he's blocking the cubicle. And it's like, get away. And these stories and the way that when they do tell, the lack of response or the, well, you really shouldn't have done that, or why don't you find another job? And the problem is you love the job. You just don't like this person speaking to you this way. And it's
and
something that
you have to change your life. I mean,
that's
something Laura has said hundreds of times.
Yeah.
Just like based on, you know, the earlier question you asked, just why are we so focused on the victims and how they have to cure the situation
right.
as opposed to preventing people from being bad to the victim in the first place?
Yeah, like, why are you protecting this person? You know, why protect this person? So in doing that, the question of, like, what's the greatest response you've gotten? It's been people being, like, because now I call that segment serial sexual harassment. I read people's letters and we talk about it, is people saying, I literally changed my life. I am no longer going to go into business with this person that I had doubts about. Or just the other day, I got this great email with this girl said she was in Chicago. She was driving and she'd looked to the zero to stop sign. She looked over and there was a cab driver and she happened to catch eye contact with him. And he started doing really gross, lewd things to her with his face and his tongue and his hands. And so she drove away and she's so grossed out and she's shaking. And then she's like, no, I listen to Juicy Scoop. And I'm not going to just feel gross about myself. So she got behind the cab. She memorized the number or wrote it down because... reported it as him being inappropriate and gross. Then I, in fact, reported that same license plate on the show.
Good.
And it's just like, I love just like putting it out there. Like, what are you going to do? It's so
awesome.
Yeah, why?
Giving people a voice, you see.
And that's empowerment.
And empowering them to be able to share their experiences because we all sit on things like that and feel it will reflect on us if we don't talk about it. So giving people the opportunity and giving them the platform to be able to do that is a very powerful thing. So it's so well done.
And it's so weird that you mentioned that sibling abuse thing because we just got a Facebook message from somebody who wanted Laura and Jim to talk about that on our show, that they've had, you know, years and years of this sort of really toxic relationship back and forth. So
it's giving people permission.
It's
a really important thing.
Like,
it's the same thing as what the Dash Risk Model does.
Right.
It basically allows people to share their experience and it's a permission thing.
Right.
And it validates. And there's so many good things that you don't realize are going to drop out of it because it feels people are in fear. It feels like a terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
So, it sounds
like... But it's a juicy story. So it's like whatever is a juicy story, whether it is a 40-hour mystery I see or something in the news or on my show, Juicy Scoop. But it's also I like all the Bravo shows. But I almost like look at that, like someone that's going to write a paper on the Real Housewives in college, like how they're cast and what's going on and the fame that happens to a woman that's never even auditioned for a play is now the star of one of the hit shows in 180 countries. And she was the biggest claim to fame was she was the cutest one in the pickup line at school.
There must be many master's theses about
that. I just went to Andy Cohen was speaking at the Palm, and I just went there, and this girl said, I just did my college thesis paper on the Housewives. And I was like, oh, man, like, that's pretty great. So it's like, some people are like, oh, I'm embarrassed to say I love that. But I think people can have so many interests, you know? It's like, so sometimes my show is funny all the way through, and other times it's a little more juicy. It's like whatever, or a little more serious. It's just whatever I find juicy and fun.
Exactly. You're accountable to yourself, and that's so powerful to have a podcast for that outlet. I mean, I love that.
Yeah, so it's been great, and it's great to be at Wondery with, you know, a caliber of people that are really bright and interesting, and so it's great. I love that people are discovering it more and more, because it's amazing like how many mother daughters come to my show, and sometimes it's the mother that introduced the daughter to it. And so it's like it used to be a younger thing, and it's just growing more and more of how people are enjoying it and understand how to listen and how easy it is. And
so speaking of listening, mm-hmm. what do you do, because it's a reality for everybody, what do you do about listeners who don't really listen, who are just on there to judge and be negative and troll?
Well, sometimes I get kind of angry. Sometimes I, you know, take the time to write people back. Well, they'll say something. And me as an interviewer, I've gotten better in the last year and a half. I do get people that say, you cut off Holly Madison. I just read that Holly Madison is the playmate from like the Hefner thing. And I remember the interview, and I remember she really wasn't that great of an interview. So I was interrupting her to get her to a better, juicier spot, you know? And then I'm listening to you talk about listening, and I'm like, I probably could work on that.
Are you now reflecting?
Yes, exactly. And so I try to look at it, and then when I have people write me something that I know I said in the podcast, and I was like, you didn't listen to the end. You didn't hear what I said, or I didn't say that, you know, or they sometimes people are listening to me being an edgy comic. There's people looking for you to say something racist or sexist, or they're trying to find
to lift that out of context.
Why did you say her roommate was a 15-year-old Mexican? I go, well, he was 15. And he was Mexican. Why? And that's how she wrote the letter to me. And I'm reading this girl's story about how she had a roommate who moved in. They were in college, and a 15-year-old Mexican boy moved in with them. You're mad at me that I said that he was Mexican? I just shut up. Like, don't listen. Like, what are you saying that I can't even describe someone's ethnicity? I say I'm white. Like, what is the... So there's sometimes things like that where I'm like, okay, I'm not going to worry about that. And that's what I also like about the podcast is in this age of where comedians have been taped at a club, 30 seconds of something can ruin someone's career, or a tweet. And that's short. I mean, I am careful about what I tweet and post, but I'm not as careful about the podcast because I feel like the people that are listening to me listen to me all the time. The thing is an hour long. They've listened to hours and hours. If I say something, they know me like a friend. They know I'm not evil or racist or don't care, you know? So it's like this relaxing thing of where you're not going to really be challenged by a soundbite.
Yeah, you're uninhibited, yeah.
Because they're actually listening to you.
Right.
Right? They're not just hearing for one little thing that they can, you know, judge you on or take out of context.
Yeah, or someone take one sentence and make that the headline on TMZ and nobody even reads the whole article, let alone listen to the hour podcast that it came from.
Right.
And so with my guests, I always say, look, this isn't live. That's not what I'm out to do. If there's something that you need to cut after, fine. I'm not going to be taking one sentence and putting it out there 4 days before someone can listen to the podcast. Like, I just think that's not fair to your guests, and that's not fair journalism, you know?
So another question, which podcast do you listen to?
Well, listen to you guys.
Correct answer. Yes. We're all cheering.
Gotta love real current profile.
And I listened to I listened to Kate Casey, who is also here at Wondery, and she's a really fun mom and writer that I found. I just like that she's a mom, she's four kids. And she's obsessed with reality shows, but like in a weird way where she goes back to like almost like one hit wonder reality stars and kind of finds where their life has gone since.
Oh, wow.
And so her show is here, and it's The Reality Life with Kate Casey, as well as people that are on shows. But she's really bright, but she, you know, takes it like we're both sort of fascinated how in this day and age that can happen, which it never really could happen before. You as a casting director know that. So, yeah, so I love that podcast. I love Ross Matthews podcast. So I like fun stuff, but then I like deeper stuff too, you know. And I liked Serial, and we sometimes listen to things like that when we're going, you know, on a long trip or whatever. Yeah. That's really good when you're like in the canyons.
Yeah, Serial was great.
Yeah.
I think that was the one that really got me hooked into them. And now I do listen to a real variety, but it just depends what I'm doing where.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, you need to be in a place where you can really listen and absorb it.
Yes.
Whereas sometimes it's just too much sensory information coming at you. And it's, you know, you need to, some things I like to keep sacred and special, some podcasts that when I'm alone and I'm running and I can really absorb what's being said.
It's nice when someone's like, because of you, I'm stayed on the you know, on the track longer, I ran longer, whatever. And then there's sometimes where I'm like, I always tell people it's great when you listen to a podcast. You can clean your house. You can do other things. But then I find myself just sitting, like sitting just because I'm so intrigued that I'm not even doing anything. And
right.
I'm like, well, now that sort of defeats the purpose, but maybe not. You know, sometimes it's okay if you're laying in your bed listening too.
But that's the problem with multitasking, isn't it? We always try and do far too many things. And sometimes you have to just bring it back and strip it down to the quality.
Yes.
So that you're doing one thing at one time and actually getting the quality experience from that and the listening and the learning. You know, I love to learn through podcasts as well, but also the cases, you know, like Serial, where you're turning it over in your mind as well, whether it makes sense, whether it doesn't, whether they could look at things in a slightly different way. So those ones I have to pay much more attention to.
This was so great. It was so great to meet you finally.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you guys could we could all join in here together in this.
Yeah, now we have another great podcast to listen to.
Right.
So, yeah.
Just get off on me. Yeah. Juicy scoop, guys.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Signing off for Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.